This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A surprising amount of planet Earth is frozen. It's been that way for millions of years, all during our life and evolution. Last December, the world's leading experts on this frozen land and sea warned Earth is heading into irreversible loss in the cryosphere, as they call it. Nothing short of an ice age, perhaps, can avoid incredible changes that will rearrange sea levels, cities, and life as we know it. And I hate to say it, but practically nobody heard them. Scientists and civil servants who know this danger have gathered into a largely volunteer group called the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative, known as ICCI. They've issued a report called Thresholds and Closing Windows, Risks of Irreversible Cryosphere Climate Change. We're joined by one of the coordinators of that report, Pam Pearson, the director of ICCI. Pam, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. Well, I think the first thing to grasp is that politics and propaganda cannot change the simple fact of physics. Once the temperature goes over 0 degrees C or 32 Fahrenheit, water changes to a liquid. We can't talk our way out of that, can we?
No, we really can't. And that's probably the basic message of this report and that the scientists are trying to get across. It's not just that once water reaches 0 degrees C or 32 degrees Fahrenheit, but it melts. In order to bring it back into a frozen state, you need to go below that level then in order to refreeze it. And even more importantly, some of the things that get unfrozen are not going to be able to be frozen again, such as permafrost, for example, until you have a much more prolonged ice age. The other very, very alarming dynamic that really has only become clear since AR5, I would say, the IPCC's fifth assessment report that came out about 3 years ago now, and that's that some of these processes, once they get started, particularly in West Antarctica, once these large ice sheets start moving, in order to stop that movement, you need to go well below freezing, well below levels where we are today in order to stop that, because the mass of the ice, the motion of the ice, the melting at the base of these glaciers from seawater simply gets going almost like a kind of conveyor belt. And in those kinds of processes, you're looking at temperatures below pre-industrial or below anything really that humanity has experienced since the dawn of civilization. And that's the fear of a lot of the scientists working in these regions especially, that they feel has not been adequately heard by the policy world.
All right. Now, your report is broken up into five major chapters. Could you just kind of summarize what they are?
Yeah, these are some of the most important irreversible thresholds specifically associated with cryosphere. There are other really important things like coral bleaching, what's happening with mangroves, but we simply focused on these particular five because they're approaching a zone of irreversibility. The first are the ice sheets, primarily on Antarctica, but not just West Antarctica, also East Antarctica, which until a few years ago was really thought not to be impacted that much by climate change. That's now known not at all to be true. And, of course, Greenland. And together, these ice sheets hold about 200 meters of sea level rise, so an awful lot of potential sea level rise in these ice sheets. The second are mountain glaciers, which are really important to the communities around them as a resource of water, water regulation, and so on. The third is permafrost, which as it melts releases carbon either in the form of methane or carbon dioxide, both of which can drive climate change further. And of course, when permafrost melts, it can cause damage to infrastructure, and we've already seen examples of that, for example, in Alaska and northern Canada. The fourth is Arctic sea ice, which won't contribute to sea level rise because it's already in the water, but it has a major role to play in terms of reflectivity at the top of the globe and has impacts, for example, on the Arctic ecosystem and on permafrost. So it's a very important threshold and one that's changing extremely fast. And the fifth and perhaps least well understood is polar ocean acidification. Because these waters are colder, acidification is occurring all over the globe. But cold water, in essence, absorbs carbon at a faster rate than warmer water. And so these waters are acidifying at a much faster rate than what you see in other parts of the globe. So you're beginning to see impacts already on some of the smaller shelled organisms in this part of the world that form part of the food chain. And so there's a lot of fear, if this continues, that you're going to start seeing some impacts on fisheries and other resources at levels that we're going to be reaching probably this century unless we're able to turn things around. So the five thresholds to summarize are ice sheets, mountain glaciers, permafrost, Arctic sea ice, and then polar ocean acidification.
You know, the Arctic has been unbelievably hot this past winter. It rained in the dark of December, unheard of. And I just read the Arctic February was more like the temperature we would expect in June. Why does the Arctic warm so much more than places where most of us live?
Well, it's not just the Arctic, actually. It's also all of these cryosphere regions. Antarctica, probably the fastest warming place on Earth, is on the Antarctic Peninsula, for example. So that's also warming more rapidly. And alpine areas also are warming much more quickly when you're high up. And that's one of the reasons why it's a combination of altitude, but then also one gets with climate change, polar amplification, and it's much, much greater in the Arctic than it is in Antarctica. Why is not entirely well understood, but it probably has something to do in part with what's going on, say, with the Arctic sea ice, that you're losing that level of reflectivity. And it could be also a result of permafrost. It's really not well understood why they're warming more quickly, but these are observations, not models, that they are warming more quickly. And it's 2 to 3 times actually faster than the rest of the globe. If one goes down to pre-industrial levels, and we actually have a graph on this in the report, thresholds, actually, parts of the Arctic have warmed by 3.5 degrees C, which is much, much more than you usually see cited, because we're sort of lowballing it sometimes when it comes to climate change in these areas by starting the clock, say, at 1950 or starting the clock at 1900. But if one goes back to pre-industrial, where we do have a fair number of records, and so many scientists are willing to call it this way, going back to, say, the 1850s, it's about a 3.5 degree temperature rise. And the global temperature, I'm not quite sure if it's been called for, 1.0 degrees at this point or very, very close to that starting in 2015. But that's almost, 3.5 times more of a temperature rise than you're seeing elsewhere. So it's quite a startling difference. And even in a lot of mountain regions that are equatorial, you're seeing temperature rises that are twice what you're seeing elsewhere in the globe. So you're seeing climate change a lot more quickly in these regions.
So let's suppose, Pam Pearson, by some miracle, the nations of the world wake up and they keep all the promises they made at the Paris Climate Talks of 2015. Would that save the great ice fields in the Arctic and the Antarctic?
It would be extremely difficult. It is still possible, yes. But the pathway that we're on right now is nowhere near what would be required. Some of these triggers or dynamics have already been triggered. It seems more likely than not that the West Antarctic ice sheet has already entered a state of collapse and that halting that is going to be very, very difficult. We could slow it down, however, and that would give, humanity and ecosystems more time to adapt to a sea level rise that's probably going to be somewhere between 3 and 4 meters. But certainly, if we want to try and stop it, if we can hold temperatures to today's levels, we certainly would at least have some chance of doing so. The problem is that the Paris Agreement, as it now stands, would have us see temperatures already by the end of this century that are about 2.5 times that. The estimates range from 2.6 to 3.5 degrees by 2100. The problem is that's just the start of the warming. which would continue up to somewhere between 3.5 and 4.2 degrees by 2300. And also the processes that are getting started, we're not going to see them anytime soon. But the point that we and the scientists are really trying to make is that the processes themselves, once started, cannot be stopped. And so we will see these levels of sea level rise, even if it takes a long, long time to take place, hundreds or even thousands of years. If we have any chance of stopping it, then we really needed, and this is one message we were really trying to hammer home as much as we could in Paris, even 1.5 degrees is quite high in the danger zone for most of these thresholds. There's very little chance that we're going to have Arctic summer sea ice at 1.5 degrees, for example. We're going to lose probably at least 30% of the permafrost at 1.5 degrees. And those are conservative estimates. These are not, you know, radical estimates. They're fairly well grounded in the science at this point, which is why the fact that this message has not gotten through to the policy world seemed more and more alarming to a lot of these scientists, and that's why they were willing to really step up, and many of them actually came to Paris to try to talk through this message with policymakers. And I would say that we were seeing some of that message start to come through, because prior to Paris, I think that the emphasis was very much on, for example, 2.0 degrees. And hopefully, I would hope that because of the message that was coming out about what is already happening in cryosphere, as well as messages from, say, small island developing states that are already seeing the, you know, their countries disappear, really, and knowing that their countries will disappear, that got through. And so 1.5 degrees is still on the table. There's a special report that's going to be coming out in 2018 looking at implications and pathways that could lead to 1.5 degrees. But again, I can't emphasize enough, 1.5 degrees is well within the danger zone for most of these processes. And we're looking at twice that at this point in time, unless these commitments by countries are strengthened.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Pam Pearson, the director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative. We are talking about irreversible changes to Earth's frozen lands and seas. Right, and you know, my reading in this report seems like the most optimistic of the current proposals to reduce emissions still brings the burden of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to around 600 parts per million by the end of this century. To me, that's like a disaster. We're already losing billions of tons of ice from Greenland and West Antarctica. What would those higher CO2 levels mean?
Those CO2 levels would mean that we would be well above the areas where you're going to see most of the permafrost, certainly majority of the permafrost thawing. You're going to be losing West Antarctica and Greenland. You're going to be losing Arctic sea ice in the summertime and during greater parts of the year. And the other thing that is really, really alarming and that a lot of people still haven't heard about is ocean acidification. And we're focused on polar ocean acidification. But at 600 parts per million, that is almost certainly going to lead to such high levels, such a lower pH, in other words, that we really haven't seen. The world's oceans have had a really, really stable pH over about the last 35 million years. It's been a very, very long time since it's varied. And so all of the organisms that we have today, or most of them certainly, have evolved in this level of pH. What's going to happen to them if we get a more, you know, acidic system is going to be, it's almost unimaginable because we haven't seen that ecosystem for such a long time. The time frames that we're looking at to go back to temperatures and CO2 concentrations like we're contemplating, you know, possibly by the end of this century, we haven't really seen, again, for 35 million years. And one of the most striking visuals I've ever seen was an Antarctic scientist, it's called a paleoclimatologist, looking at ancient climate systems, where they were trying to talk about the way the ice sheets on Antarctica have behaved at CO2 levels, again, that we haven't seen for about 35 to 50 million years. And the visual she was showing in terms of ocean currents looked really funny, and it took me a while to realize. The reason is continental drift. The continents were closer together at that point in time. And so in order to try and figure out what is going to happen at these CO2 levels, the scientists studying this need to consider the fact that, ocean currents were a little bit different because North America, South America, and Europe, Africa were closer together at that point in time. That's just really mind-blowing that, we are contemplating a globe that is so very different from anything we've seen in human history. It's really playing with fire, or some of the scientists would pun it, playing with ice.
Well, the fifth assessment of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, did say that many aspects of climate change are, quote, largely irreversible on human timescales, end quote. But, Pam, they buried that on page 1033 of a fat report that hardly anyone reads. How did 15 scientists try to get that idea out further in the Guardian newspaper last December?
And, by the way, at the end of the day, we ended up, I believe, with 26 scientists who were willing to sign on to that ad, which I found almost very moving. Scientists are a conservative bunch. They don't like being advocates, but these particular scientists, again, are very, very concerned at what they are seeing and observing, not just modeling, but seeing in the cryosphere. I've been working in this area. I'm an ex-diplomat and returned to the climate change field again in 2006. From that date to now, what I've been seeing is a growing level of alarm from more and more scientists about what they see happening and what the implications are. And what that's translated into is a growing willingness and almost a desire, really, to engage in the policy world. Where this report came from was what was called the Day of the Cryosphere, where we gathered a bunch of cryosphere scientists together in Warsaw, Poland, which was 2 years before Paris, to present this. And many of them were scientists who had participated in the fifth assessment and had gone through that process of producing the summary for policymakers as in addition to the entire many thousands of page, you know, report that was the final report. And they had indeed seen their message watered down, because what a lot of people aren't aware of is that when you reach that final phase of what's going to go into the final summary, which is the most that most policymakers read, if they even read that, that's negotiated. And that's not just negotiated by the scientific community. It's negotiated by the policy community. And if there are messages that are found to be uncomfortable, then you're right. That can get very, very watered down. All of the messages are there if you're able to read between the lines or read the science. But sometimes they can be very, very difficult to parse out. And it was a discomfort with that process that led a lot of these scientists then to really want to start engaging in the climate negotiations and the UNFCCC processes, just to make sure that they at least had made sure, as certain as they possibly could as scientists, that an honest and realistic message about what is really happening globally was going to be in front of negotiators when they were meeting. I think that scientists see this as a crisis, the kind of crisis that would bring people together in wartime. That level of understanding of crisis just isn't there in the general public just yet. And so I think there is still a bit of an unwillingness to take the kinds of steps that might be necessary to address it.
You know, one thing I found missing in this report is the threat of melting frozen methane on the seabed, known as clathrates. Other scientists I've talked to see clathrates as a likely driver in past mass extinction events. Why isn't it done up more in the ICCI report?
We really contemplated that. And the problem with the science between the clathrates is that there's still a lot of controversy about it among the scientists themselves, ranging from those who see it as a far greater threat than the carbon that's in permafrost to those who think that a large portion of it is going to be absorbed by the water as it's bubbling up, in essence, so it's not going to reach the atmosphere. And because of that uncertainty, we have a line in there about class rates and that it's out there, and it is a huge amount of carbon. There's no question of that. The question is, will it reach the atmosphere and how much will it be? But there wasn't the level of scientific consensus that we had on permafrost or the other four thresholds. And it was really important at the end of the day that we focus on the science that was certain and not invite in any controversy at all, because the message of those five thresholds, including permafrost, was alarming enough as it is. And so we decided very, very consciously to be conservative. That was a controversial decision. You're right. There are some scientists who really believe that we should have had much more on it in the report. And I'm hopeful that within the next couple of years, some of the uncertainty around class rates is going to emerge, just like it did in permafrost, really just in time for Paris and the report, because the first truly consensus paper on permafrost came out about this time last year, and that enabled us to have a really strong statement on permafrost that wouldn't have been possible just a year ago. Hopefully with class rates, we're going to get there, you know, again within the next couple of years and be able to say a little bit more certainly how much carbon is going to come out at what temperature levels.
Well, of course, I'm hoping that the scientific process does not lag behind events. We shall see. I want to read in one paragraph here from the report, if I may. It says, adaptation to the levels of projected climate-related disruption, particularly sea level rise that cannot be halted and accelerates over the centuries, simply will not be possible without massive migration and other changes to human centers of population and infrastructure that will carry enormous economic and not least historic and cultural costs. That's kind of a bleak way of looking at the future, really. If we let this go, adaptation doesn't sound very possible.
No, it really isn't. I mean, you can call it adaptation if New York is relocated to an entirely different spot in the state of New York or New Jersey or Connecticut, but it won't be New York City anymore, will it? Even though those levels of sea level rise, again, they're going to take a long time to happen. I mean, right now, for example, one of the scientists who's worked on this, a lead author on a study, Anders Levermann, has looked at what would happen to UNESCO cultural sites if we even see 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 meters of sea level rise. And what we're looking at is much more than that. And the number of sites that would be lost is just huge. In human timescales, we're really not talking about that long ago. And what we're doing is condemning history, or condemning to history, I suppose I should say, sites of civilization that have existed for a very long time and that we will not be able to, you know, preserve. You can't build levees that high and preserve these sites, these ecosystems. And the only thing we can do, again, is to prevent it from happening in the first place. And that means action now, action really within the next 5 to 15 years. The very depressing thing about a lot of the policy debate is the degree to which leaders are saying, we'll do this in 2050 or we'll do this in 2040. Given what we already see happening right now, that is way too late to stop these processes from happening. We can't have goals of carbon neutrality really in 2100. That's way too late. And even 2050 is way too late. We really need to be aiming much, much earlier. And with all the tools that we have at our disposal to addressing things like black carbon and methane, where, you know, it works a lot more quickly if you take those emissions down, putting that all together into an emergency package really is what it's going to take in order to slow these cryosphere processes down.
Could you fill us in about the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative? Just briefly, who is that? How did this happen?
Well, I founded it right after, or almost, I should say, standing in Bella Center in Copenhagen, sort of watching what we had hoped would be a climate agreement fall apart. I've been working with climate scientists who are focused on areas like the Arctic and the dynamics that were ongoing there. And as I reached out to more and more scientists as an ex-diplomat trying to bring them into the climate negotiations, I'd become aware that it wasn't just the Arctic, it was also mountain areas, and it was also Antarctica. And there really wasn't an organization that was focused on the science or policies relating to climate change that existed. And so it was a gap that I and some of the people I was working with thought to fill. Since then, we've simply been reaching out to more and more scientists and policymakers, many of them ex-climate negotiators, a lot of them from Arctic countries, but some of the people who were involved are from India, for example, and are also concerned about these kinds of dynamics because of sea level rise. And then the other key thing that happened in Paris was an agreement that the commitments, or INDCs as they're called, will be revised already in 2020, and they need to be much stronger than they were in 2015. Because right now there's just way too much, I would say, intentional blindness, or kind of a sense that, oh, we've still got time. And we really don't have very much time when it comes to the cryosphere.
We've been talking about a new report, Thresholds and Closing Windows, Risks of Irreversible Cryosphere Climate Change. Our guest was one of the authors and overseers, Pam Pearson. She's the director of the International Cryosphere Climate Initiative, or ICCI. You can find out more at icci.net.org. You can also find links to this report and helpful articles in my weekly Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info. Pam, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for your interest.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.